Good day.
Today is Monday, 26th January 2026. And before I begin this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched this programme or whichever part of the programme you want to watch, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. So today's programme, I'm going to return to the talks in Abu Dhabi. Over the weekend, yesterday to be precise, we had statements that were appearing in the United States, in Politico and Axios, which I discussed in yesterday's programme. Statements that originated from two anonymous US officials. I'm going to guess that these were Kushner and Witkoff. And anyway, they tried to put their own relatively optimistic spin on the Abu Dhabi meeting, suggesting that there'd been progress, though they were unable to identify what that progress actually was. Anyway, they talked about progress, they talked about a friendly atmosphere, they talked about how everybody sat down to lunch together, they spoke about the possibility of Putin and Zelensky eventually meeting. Anyway, they gave a very optimistic spin of the meeting in Abu Dhabi. I, of course, have provided a much more nuanced view based on a careful parsing of the two articles in Politico and Axios. I suggested that this should be understood as the first working party, the first step, if you like, in a complex negotiating process that ought logically to have begun last year, perhaps in February, after Putin and Trump first spoke on the phone, perhaps after the Anchorage summit in Alaska, where it seemed that the Americans had come round to agreeing with the Russians various ways to move forward towards a settlement of the conflict in Ukraine, based ultimately on Putin's proposals, the ones he made to the Russian Foreign Ministry on the 14th of June 2024, and which we on the Duran speak about as Istanbul Plus. And in fact, my recollection is that at that meeting, there was already some discussion about setting up working groups. And certainly, Putin floated the idea of working groups later in August 2025 over the course of a telephone call that he had with Trump, even as Zelensky and the Europeans were in another part of the White House. Putin, to be precise, reminded Trump that the Russians, during their last meeting with the Ukrainians in Istanbul, had suggested three working parties, working groups, one of which would deal with security issues. And, well, that working group, in effect, was eventually formed as a result of the meeting between Putin, Witkoff and Kushner in Moscow a few days ago. And it was that working group which, with the participation of the Americans, had its first meeting in Abu Dhabi. And I pointed out also that the presence of the Americans at this working group changed the dynamics, that it meant that for the first time the United States was involved directly in the negotiations. It was no longer acting in a manner that is consistent with a mediator, even if you accept that the United States has indeed been engaged in mediation over the last year, which is, of course, a fantastical concept anyway. But the fact that the Americans participated in the meeting, that they were there, that they were present over the course of this meeting that they met with the Russians and with the Ukrainians, that they were, as it turns out, present at every point of the discussions. That essentially confirms that the Americans are no longer really mediators anymore, or even pretending to be mediators anymore. Whatever they say, they are instead direct participants and indeed parties in the negotiations that are taking place, which is as it should be, given that American officials themselves, Marco Rubio specifically, the US Secretary of State, have admitted that the conflict in Ukraine is a proxy war between Russia and the United States, in which case it makes far more sense for the two main participants, Russia and the United States, to talk with each other rather than worry too much about the proxy. So that, in my opinion, is what basically happened in Abu Dhabi over the weekend. And I also said that I thought almost certainly the topic of the attack on Valdai was brought up by the Russians. I don't know what the Americans and the Ukrainians said about it, but I said that one could get a sense from the use of words like de-escalation and all topics came under discussion from the Politico and Axios articles, that was the case. And for the record, there's been a carefully worded message by Dmitry Medvedev, the deputy chair of Russia's Security Council and the man who supervises Russia's Military Industrial Commission, which to my mind comes very close to confirming it. He says that the Russians have this enormously great nuclear capacity, nuclear warfare capacity, that this is what has deterred the United States from far more aggressive action against Russia. He then brought up the way in which the Russians are able to calm the Americans because of their capabilities. He then went straight on to discuss the Valdai attack, and he spoke about how the Russians could carry out strikes, counter-strikes of their own using innovative weapons, which is an elliptical way, or so it seemed to me, of referring to the Oreshnik strike on Lvov. And in effect, what Medvedev said, or at least this is my interpretation of his words, is that after the Oreshnik strike, after the Valdai strike, the Russians basically sobered the Ukrainians down. They demonstrated again their capability, the Oreshnik strike, and they impressed upon the Americans that something like that must never happen again. And that suggests to me, especially with Medvedev's comment coming out directly after the meeting in Abu Dhabi, it suggests to me that this issue, this topic, was indeed discussed in Abu Dhabi. I would be astonished were that not the case, by the way. Anyway, so that's what the Americans have been saying. But over the last 24 hours, rather belatedly, the Russians have begun to weigh in. And we're getting everything from Peskov, who is Putin's spokesman. And entirely unsurprisingly, he is taking a much more sober view of the negotiations, the talks in Abu Dhabi. First of all, he appeared to deny that the atmosphere had been friendly. He says, if you're working at an expert level, then at minimum you should behave constructively towards each other. I would not say there was a friendly atmosphere. However, this is unlikely at this stage of the talks. However, if we are aiming to achieve results through negotiations, we need to communicate constructively with each other. So he said that the mood was perhaps polite and, as he put it, constructive, in the sense that neither side was shouting and banging the table or doing anything of that kind. But contrary to what the Americans have been saying, it wasn't friendly either. So that was one thing that Peskov said. Peskov also said something else. He said that it would be a mistake to expect any high results from the initial contacts. This is a very complex matter with complex issues on the agenda. But the very fact that these contacts have begun constructively can be seen as positive. However, there is significant work ahead, which is essentially exactly what I said in my programme yesterday. This is a small first step. It's a working party. There are still oddities about this working party. It still looks very ragged around the edges. I'll just return to that topic in a moment. But it is perhaps closer to a conventional negotiation in this conflict than anything we have seen up to now. It perhaps might evolve into something like that. But we are very, very much at the start of this process, nowhere close to its end. And notice that Peskov talks about initial contacts, complex matter, complex issues on the agenda, a significant work ahead. We are only at the beginning of what might evolve into the first real substantive negotiation of this conflict that we have seen up to now. And may I say that the change, the major change, the thing that has possibly altered the dynamic is the presence of the Americans. The full involvement of the Americans. Peskov confirmed that there would be another meeting in about a week's time. He refused to give the date, but it looks as if the Americans, Driscoll and Grinkevich perhaps, will be there again. So there will be more meetings between the Americans and the Russians, and the Russians and the Ukrainians, all of them talking to each other in the same room. But we have a very, very long way to go. And there has been no consensus or agreement. In fact, the New York Times gave us something of a sense of the sort of discussions that took place, apparently, over the course of the meeting, over the course of the meetings in Abu Dhabi. The Americans and the Ukrainians floated the idea, which has appeared in many of the extraordinary kaleidoscope of plans that we have seen coming out of Europe and the United States and the Ukraine over the last couple of weeks. The idea of a free trade zone in the areas of Donbass still under Ukrainian control. The Ukrainians pull out, a free trade zone is declared, and troops from neutral countries go there and maintain control, with Ukraine, of course, still claiming sovereignty. I said that this proposal would be unacceptable to the Russians. Surprise, surprise, they rejected it outright over the course of the Abu Dhabi meeting. And, well, we have the New York Times confirming as much. So the Americans and the Ukrainians floated this particular idea, and the Russians instantly shot it down. So we get a sense of some of the talks and manoeuvres that are taking place. And that is, by the way, useful. It is important. As Eve Smith has pointed out now several times, the great problem with the West is that in conflicts of this type, it spends all its time negotiating with itself rather than with the other side. It therefore comes up with fantastic plans, like the free trade zone in Donbass, patrolled by troops from neutral countries, which never have any possibility of being accepted by the Russians. Over the course of the talks in Abu Dhabi, this was finally and hopefully conclusively clarified. The Russians made it absolutely clear they regard Donbass as their sovereign territory and they want the Ukrainians to leave, and that there is nothing further to discuss about it. So anyway, that's the Americans. That's what the Russians have been saying. Now, Peskov said something else, and he actually said that yesterday when I found it very interesting, because he made the same point that I've made about the American approach to these negotiations before. Back in the spring of last year, when the Americans were talking about a ceasefire and were trying to pressure everybody to agree to a ceasefire on the existing conflict lines, I said that the Americans were at risk of giving the impression to the Russians that they were in a hurry to end the war. And the Russians would unquestionably see that as a sign of weakness, and a sign of weakness that they would be able to take advantage of. And Peskov said exactly that yesterday. He said that the Americans are in a hurry. When they met Putin, one of the reasons why the meeting with Putin, the one that took place a few days ago, went on for so many hours was because the Americans were anxious to move the process forward and were trying to explore all options with him. They managed to get the agreement to the Working Party, but of course they didn't get any substantive concessions from Putin whatsoever. And the Russians are again concluding that the Americans are in a hurry. And why are they in a hurry? Well, it's not difficult to understand why. Ukraine is losing the war. Sooner or later, it's going to start to unravel and break down and collapse. The front lines have not yet collapsed, but they are cracking, and they're cracking badly. Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, the last big line of defence in Donbass, is now under pressure and over the next few months is likely to fall. The cities in Ukraine are in the midst of an energy crisis and there are blackouts in many of them. So the war in Ukraine is being lost. The United States is depleting its arsenals, has depleted its Arctic arsenals critically by trying to keep this war going. It's been sending Patriot missiles and other weapons to Ukraine, running down its own stockpiles and its own arsenals. It's short of ammunition. It's short of other things. And this is dangerous for the United States, given the level of commitments the United States has around the world. And it is particularly dangerous given that the United States is focused mostly now on the Asia-Pacific region, where it needs to confront, or where it's chosen to confront, China, as the security strategy review document of a few days ago and the national and the Pentagon's own defense strategy document made clear. And the Americans also have now seen how weak the Europeans are. that the Europeans are incapable of holding back the Russians by themselves. They do not want a crisis in Europe, even as they want to focus their resources on the Asia-Pacific region, because that is where the Chinese are becoming stronger and stronger. And for that reason, the Americans want to reach some kind of long-term understanding with Russia that will stabilize the situation in Europe. And they're even talking now about trying to improve the relations between Europe and Russia as well. And if you understand American strategic priorities, all of this makes sense. The original plan to destabilize Russia, to defeat its army, to create a regime change crisis in Moscow has failed. There have been various attempts over the course of 2025 to revive it. There was Lindsey Graham's bone-crushing sanctions idea. There was the sanctions, Scott Bessent's sanctions on Rosneft and Lukoil. There was the attack on Valdai and the attempt to assassinate Putin, which I have no doubt that was. But ultimately and always, they come back to square one. They can't achieve the objective of destabilizing Russia, of causing a political crisis there, of suffocating its economy or defeating its army on the battlefronts. So, in this situation, they have no choice but to try to find some means, either to get the Russians to agree to stop advancing, but the Russians have consistently rejected that. They said that Istanbul Plus is the minimum of what they will insist on. Or if they cannot get the Russians to stop, then at least to come to some understanding with the Russians that will enable the United States to reduce its footprint, its military footprint in Europe, so that it can focus more on the Asia-Pacific region. And of course, on top of these strategy issues, there is the question of President Trump's personal vanity, his desire to go down in history as the great peacemaker, the person who ended the war in Ukraine. And in Trump's case, what is part vanity is probably also part political calculation. Also, he does not want the situation with the Russians to escalate. He does not want to get himself into a situation where there might be confrontations with the Russian Navy on the high seas because of demands to start seizing Russian-flagged and registered tankers. He does not want a bigger crisis. And he probably also calculates that a resolution of the crisis, one which gets energy supplies moving more freely again, will benefit him politically, because it will bring down the price of energy, which is what he wants to see in the United States. So the Americans have all of these factors at play, and that makes them want to end this war quickly. The Americans have said this. The Strategic Strategy Review said that it was an urgent, the word urgent was actually used, an urgent priority for the United States to end the Ukraine war and to prevent its escalation, and that it was a priority for the United States to come to some understanding with Russia for all the reasons that I have just outlined. That is not the consensus in the United States. It is only the opinion of a faction, but that particular faction is currently in the ascendant, And it is that faction which is centred for the moment in the Pentagon, which was present at the talks in Abu Dhabi. The rival factions, which might be hostile to these negotiations, the State Department and the CIA, were kept away. So the Russians see all of this. They know all of this. They know that Trump and at least some of his officials are in a hurry. And the Russians respond, will respond to all of this by taking their time. They will insist on going through everything line by line and point by point, because hard-nosed and tough-minded negotiators as they are, they know that when the other side is in a hurry, when it is under pressure, that makes it more likely over time that it will make the important concessions. And Peskov saying that the Americans are in a hurry shows that that is exactly what the Russians are thinking, what they are saying to each other, and what undoubtedly is going to shape their approach to the negotiations. So, to repeat again Peskov's words, it's a mistake to expect any high results from the initial contacts. This is a very complex matter with complex issues on the agenda. There is significant work ahead. The Americans are in a hurry. The Russians are not. The Americans give a positive spin on what happened in Abu Dhabi. The Russians don't. The Russians, unwilling, refusing to make compromises. The Americans ultimately obliged to make them, because from their point of view, it is they who must make the deal. So this, I think, represents the current thinking in Moscow. And going back to other things that I've said in the past, given that the Russians sense that they are in the stronger position, they have no reason to make concessions, and it's entirely possible, highly plausible, very likely, that as Putin apparently told Trump over the course of their last telephone call, that the Russians might be preparing to up their demands when the substantive talks take place. And those substantive talks so far, to repeat again, haven't really started. We are still at the exploratory stage. Now, that's the Russians. The Ukrainians have also been talking as well. To be precise, Zelensky has. And his comments were extraordinarily shrill. He again ruled out any territorial concessions to the Russians whatsoever. No Ukrainian withdrawal from Donbass. No acceptance that Donbass is Russian. No Ukrainian concessions, territorial concessions anywhere, at any point. Everything belongs to Ukraine. What the Ukrainians still control, what is in their physical possession, they will defend. They're not prepared to give anything up. So a flat rejection of Russian demands, demands which, be it noted, the Americans are apparently committed, they committed themselves in Anchorage, at least in part, to supporting. So the dynamic of the negotiations that probably took place in Abu Dhabi and which will continue from this point on is of the Russians and the Americans agreeing with each other on the territorial question, and of the Ukrainians being left out in the cold. And Zelensky, very unhappy, very angry that his European friends are not there at the negotiating table. Back in the spring of last year, the Europeans were insisting that they should be at the negotiating table. Negotiations are now taking place. The Europeans are not there. The Americans and the Russians are. And the Ukrainians have been left to look after themselves. Zelensky's furious about this. Undoubtedly, it played a part in his extraordinary tirade against the Europeans in Davos. He called them weak, spineless, unable to stand up, not just to the Russians, but to the Americans as well. He's furious that he was forced to send a delegation to Abu Dhabi to meet with the Russians and the Americans by itself without the Europeans present to lend their support. He's furious with the Europeans for letting that happen. He criticizes them for it, and he says that in future, when there's a final settlement, they must be there. So, again, you can see why Zelensky is unhappy, and he has pointedly said so. And Zelensky, again, saying that a security guarantee from the United States to Ukraine has already been agreed. The principles of this have already been agreed. The Americans, by the way, have been much more evasive about this, but Zelensky insists that this guarantee is ready to be signed off on. He says that it's up to Trump to decide when the signature of the document should be made, which, by the way, looks to me like a demand that this document should indeed be signed. He was expecting or hoping to sign such a document when he went to Davos. He probably went to Davos in the belief that something, at least, would be signed there, preferably the security guarantee document, or if not that, at least the $800 billion reconstruction document, which he could take back to Kiev in order to reassure people there that the money flow, this critically important money flow to Kiev, will resume. So he was furious that no such documents were ready for signature. He's insisting, he's demanding now that it must be signed. And he doesn't just want it signed. He wants it ratified forthwith, without delay, by the US Senate, preempting the negotiations with the Russians. And he wants it signed and ratified by the Ukrainian Parliament as well. But of course, a treaty like that can only be ratified by the Senate if Donald Trump signs it. And for the moment, at least, Donald Trump is not signing it, because it seems he has understood that if the United States were to do such a thing, not only would it be making a commitment to Ukraine now, but it would almost certainly be taking a step that would destroy the negotiation process that has begun in Abu Dhabi, which is, as I said, keen to succeed for all the reasons that I have outlined. So he is dragging his feet on that. Security guarantee document can only be signed, according to the Americans, as part of a final settlement, a final agreement of the conflict. And that means that the Russians will have a say, and the Russians have already rejected that idea, the idea of security guarantees in that form outright, and have said so, said as much in many places. So Zelensky, nonetheless, furious that that hasn't been given, insisting on it, wanting it to be ratified by the Senate immediately. He also demands immediate entry for Ukraine, by the way, into the European Union. Not only does he want the Europeans participating in the talks, but he wants the Europeans alongside and treating Ukraine as a formal ally, if not through membership of NATO, at least through membership of the European Union. And he's becoming increasingly frustrated and angry that that hasn't happened. Hungary, of course, solidly opposes this membership bid by Ukraine. Austria also has said that it is hostile to this idea. And about a week ago, there was an interesting article in the Financial Times which said that the European Commission's attempt to fast-track Ukraine's membership of NATO, of the EU, with proposals that Ukraine could join the EU but only participate in some of its institutions but not in others, that this was encountering opposition from member states, some EU member states, obviously going beyond the usual suspects, Hungary, Slovakia and those, with some member states coming back and saying that this was an incredibly bad idea, that it set an awful precedent that other countries, Turkey for example, might say, well, if you can do this for Ukraine, why can't you do it for us? And many, many European countries do not want Turkey joining the EU in any form, under any circumstances. So this has already provoked a row, and for the moment at least, that particular proposal seems to have been put away, shelved in a lower drawer. So, Zelensky, angry about the meeting in Abu Dhabi, angry because the Russians continue to insist on territory, the four regions, but certainly Donbass. The Americans appear to be agreeing with them. Zelensky furious about this, digging in his heels, and Zelensky unhappy, basically, about the whole process. Last year, he took a decision to call off the bilateral negotiations between Ukraine and the Russians in Istanbul. He made statements to that effect at the end of last year, as did other Ukrainian officials, and he is extremely unhappy to have been strong-armed into talks in Abu Dhabi with the Americans present and also leaning and putting pressure on him to make concessions that he doesn't want. So we are absolutely at the start of a process which may never succeed. It's also a process where a huge amount of time has been lost. If working party of this kind had been set up by the Americans back in February last year, when Trump and Putin first spoke, or if it had been set up directly after the Anchorage summit meeting, then there might have been time to move forward with this process, to give it the necessary time and space to achieve an outcome. But the Americans wasted much of last year with very incoherent diplomatic efforts. We finally got to the point where proper negotiating teams, are finally being assembled and are starting to meet. But we see that the Russians are saying that this process needs to take time. The Americans are maybe in a hurry, but we are not. It may take months. It might even take years. This is not what the Americans want. It is not what the Ukrainians want. And of course, Ukraine itself might not have those months or years. Gordon Hahn has written well about this. He said that the situation in Ukraine is so bad now that if this process takes 8 months, there might not be a Ukraine around in 8 months to complete this negotiation process. You could say, as I have said, that if this negotiation is now going to be a long and twisted road, and bear in mind that the Paris peace talks between the Americans, the North Vietnamese, and the South Vietnamese too, by the way, lasted 4 years. Well, you can see how long and twisted the road in this conflict might be. Well, if this is going to be a long and twisted road in the negotiations, well, Ukraine itself is running out of road. Its cities are in blackout. Many of its people now are living out in tents. I will come up to that shortly. And the war itself on the battlefronts is being lost. Time has been wasted. It was wasted by the Americans. It has been cataclysmically wasted by the Europeans, who, instead of doing everything they could to assist this negotiating process, have constantly and incessantly sought to sabotage it for their own selfish and frankly narcissistic reasons. And I can't help but think that this has all started now far too late in the day. We are now so close to the end that it is impossible to see how the diplomacy can speed up and catch up. And to repeat again, the Russians are saying that they are in no hurry. This process can take its time. Well, I'm going to finish this discussion of the negotiations in Abu Dhabi, my very last one for the next couple of days. I'm just going to finish with one last point, which is that a number of people have pointed to the extreme casualness in which the American negotiators were dressed over the course of this meeting. Open neck shirts, sometimes no suits. Kushner was in some kind of polo neck shirt. The Russians were all in suits, wearing ties. The Ukrainians mostly were, except for Ukrainian military officers who like to turn up in camouflage jackets to these sort of meetings, which, by the way, I also think is inappropriate. But anyway, Urmerov, always there in his black shirt, which has become a signature thing. So the Ukrainians looking pretty ragged as well, as they, by the way, have done in every meeting of the negotiators. But the Americans taking this further, perhaps to an extreme. Now, some are saying that this was a signal from the Americans trying to convey to the participants that the Americans are so far above this process that they can turn up dressed as they like. And this is a sign of extraordinary disrespect by the Americans to the other negotiating participants, the Ukrainians and the Russians. Well, I can't speak for the Ukrainians, but I'm sure that that is not how the Russians will see it. Bear in mind, the Russians are already saying that the Americans are in a hurry. The Russians will see this as a sign, again, that the American negotiators are inexperienced. They will see their slovenly appearance as a sign that they're not even properly organised or prepared for these discussions. It's going to make the Russians far from being awed or intimidated, actually, I think, rather contemptuous. It's going to make them feel that they're not dealing with the Americans, with entirely serious people. And that is going to make the Russians even more careful and even more determined to take their time. For the record, my own view is that the Americans often have a habit of doing this thing. I don't think anything specifically was intended by it. I've seen this from the Americans myself. And by the way, I remember hearing way back in the 1980s complaints in Greece about the slovenly appearance of the American ambassador to Greece in the 1950s when he turned up at the palace in Athens to meet the king in a Hawaiian shirt, unbuttoned Hawaiian shirt. So I think the Americans have a habit of doing this. I don't think they always understand the effect on the other participants of this absence of formality. Americans can often be very informal, and I think that was all there was to it in this case. But certainly, I would advise them in future, assuming they're listening to this advice, which, of course, they probably are not, I would advise them in future, when they attend meetings of this kind, to turn up dressed properly with suits and ties, however uncomfortable it might be, and to make the effort to at least appear professional in this negotiation, which, as Peskov says, is a complex matter covering difficult, complex issues. Just a sec. Anyway, that brings me back to the war. Now, we've been getting less information from the battlefronts, which, as I said many times, is not a sign that things are not happening on the battlefronts. It is more likely to be a sign that many things are happening in the battlefronts and that neither side wants us to know about them. Now, the first thing to say is that the Russian offensive against the cities continues. Yesterday, I touched on the fact that some people rather optimistically are talking about an improvement of the situation in Kiev. The situation in Kiev is improving in one respect, in that the new energy minister, Mr. Shmigal, in Ukraine, seems more competent and more together than some of his predecessors, and does indeed seem to be making a serious effort to improve the conditions for the civilian population and to get the energy system, at least the water system, functioning at least to a basic degree. 10 cities have been created in some of the cities in Ukraine, Kiev, for example, where people can be taken and kept warm inside the tents and things of that kind. Ukraine does have some capable managers, and it looks as if Mr. Shmigal might be one of them, which, by the way, begs the question in that case of why he was taken away from running the defense ministry in Kiev, which is very short of such capable administrators and people. But anyway, he at least is doing something. But the overall picture continues to be, as far as I can tell, of the energy system across Ukraine continuing to falter, even as Russian attacks continue. And we haven't yet had news, information, about attacks on the substations that connect the nuclear power plants to the electricity grid, though it's likely that those attacks will come. But there are reports now that the process that I described in a program a short time ago of the Ukrainian authorities having to drain the countryside and the smaller towns of electric energy so as to divert it, to try to keep the lights on in the cities, the big cities, at least to some extent. Anyway, it seems that that process might be intensifying, and that as a result, more and more areas of Ukraine are going dark. Now, I have said that to me, this looks very much like the kind of preparations you would expect from the Russians on the eve of a big offensive. And on the Duran, we did a program with Stanislav Krapivnik, who is, of course, somebody who follows the war very closely and who is able to understand the language and talks to the soldiers and people of this kind. And he made the point that for the Russians, storming cities, big populated centres, is significantly complicated by the presence in those cities of civilian populations. The Ukrainians do, in fairness, carry out evacuations of cities ahead of battles. But always and invariably, these happen very late, and there's usually a significant number of civilians in the cities when the Russians come. Well, if that is a problem, if that does indeed slow the Russians down, if they hesitate, for example, to attack apartment buildings that might have been converted into fortresses because of worries that civilians might be there, well, why not then, in that case, do what the Russians are doing now? Create conditions in the cities that are so intolerable that the civilian population leaves. Now, I'm not saying I agree with that or approve of it. I've already said that, in my opinion, this has something of the look of a war crime about it. In fact, I have been told positively that it is a war crime. I ought to say quickly that if so, it is a war crime which the Western powers have never hesitated to commit as well in previous wars. But this isn't the point I'm making in this programme. If the Russians are indeed turning off the electricity in the cities, if they're trying to force the population, the civilians, to leave, isn't that a clear sign that they are ultimately going to start storming these cities? Isn't this what it is all about? And if Kiev is particularly targeted, as, by the way, seems to be the case, is that not consistent with some kind of operation against Kiev, which might be in the advanced planning stage? And could that explain, perhaps, Russian activities in northeastern Ukraine, this gradual penetration of the Russians into more and more areas in Kharkiv region, with the Russians steadily expanding their footprint in Kharkiv region, also, it seems, pushing towards Kharkiv city itself, linking the two areas that they control, the Lipsy area and the Volchansk area, together. And also the Russians are doing the same in Sumy region, which is, of course, closer to Kiev. It seems that they're expanding their territorial reach in Sumy region. The Russian general in command of Group of Forces North, General Nikiforov, recently said that his soldiers are just 20 kilometers from the city of Sumy. Could it be that the Russians ultimately are preparing the ground for a storming operation of Sumy? And might it be that why another city in northeastern Ukraine, Chernigov, is now also out of electric power? Why the Russians have attacked the power stations there? why there is no power in that city, why there is blackouts, and why, again, there are reports of civilians leaving. Chernihiv is actually closer, much closer to Kiev than Sumy is. The Russians, by the way, briefly occupied the city of Sumy in February 2022 for about a day, but they didn't stay there because their forces moved on along the main highway to Kiev itself. Perhaps this time they intend not just to storm it, but to take it, to actually keep it under their control. They never did capture Chernihiv, though they did surround it in February and March 2022. And as I remember, at the time of the initialing of the draft Istanbul Agreement in April 2022, it seemed as if the Russian siege of Chernihiv might be actually tightening. But the Russians never actually attempted to storm Chernihiv itself at that time, even though it is the big city immediately to the east of Kiev. Might the fact that the Russians are now switching Chernihiv off, or at least working towards doing so, be a sign that Chernihiv, along with Sumy and Kharkiv, are now in their sights, and that they do eventually plan to move into these cities, to storm these cities, and then perhaps advance beyond these cities to Kiev itself. Now, I don't know. The Russian General Staff doesn't share its plans with me. I'm not able to say whether this is true. The Ukrainians will, of course, defend Kiev with everything they've got. Zelensky will insist on it. That might weaken Ukrainian positions elsewhere in Ukraine. There is a school of thought, by the way, that one of the major reasons why the Russians sent troops to the area around Kiev in the February and March 2022 was precisely in order to divert Ukrainian manpower from southern Ukraine, from Zaporozhye region, which of course facilitated the Russians gaining control of much of Zaporozhye and Kherson regions in the first weeks of the war, establishing their land bridge to Crimea, just to say. So anyway, it could be that this is the plan, and that this plan is in preparation, and that we are seeing the first steps towards executing that plan. As Stanislav Krapivnik has pointed out in other programmes, the Russians have no shortage of troops if such an offensive is indeed being prepared. They have two reserve armies located very close to this specific area. They have other reserve forces further in the rear. General Sirsky, the Ukrainian commander-in-chief, recently spoke about the Russians having up to 4.5 million men in trained reserves and able to recruit and planning to recruit another 400,000 men into their army this year, and to organise these men into 11 more divisions. So the Russians have no shortage of manpower. A report that just appeared admitted that the Russians have more tanks and armoured vehicles in service than they did at the start of the special military operation. All those claims that it would take the Russians decades to replace their losses from February and March 2022, it turns out were completely wrong. That doesn't surprise me, obviously. But anyway, maybe, possibly, the plan is, as I said, an offensive in the north. And quite plausibly an offensive in the south too. An offensive whose ultimate objective is Odessa, The Russians have made that fairly clear, or so it seems to me. They continue to press towards Orekhov from the east and from the west. There is heavy fighting taking place west of the Gaichur River. The Russians have captured Gulyapolye. But even though they now have strong positions west of the Gaichur River, the river itself will still be an obstacle for their logistics. They will still need to build bridges, pontoon bridges and those kind of things to get their supplies across and to build them in sufficient number and to protect them against potential Ukrainian drone attacks and that sort of thing. And the logistics are complicated, and probably the likely place where they will do that will be within the city of Gulyapolye itself, where the buildings also provide some protection from artillery and drones. So anyway, the Russians have some work to do before they advance further towards Orekhov from the east. But undoubtedly they will do it. And my guess is that we're probably not that far from the point where they will have done it as well. And west of Orekhov, the other side of the Russian pincer is becoming more active as well. General Teplinsky's troops continue to push westwards towards Orekhov, even as they're taking positions immediately to the south of Zaporozhye city, and even as the drone operators, the Russian drone operators, become increasingly busy in this area, interrupting supplies from Zaporozhye to Orekhov as well. So this area of the battlefronts, which has been the topic of a detailed discussion between ourselves on the Duran and Stanislav Krapivnik, which will be published, I think, fairly soon. Anyway, this area of the front lines is likely to become very, very active at some point in the next few weeks. And quite plausibly, quite probably, things will start to move there very quickly also. Anyway, that's one area of the battle. The other area is Donbass, where it all began, and where Zelensky has dug in his heels and continues to insist that he will never retreat from it. My sense of the Battle of Konstantinivka, the town at the southern end of the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Druzhivka, Konstantinivka conurbation, is that Konstantinivka is now turning into another meat grinder, another graveyard of what is left of the Ukrainian military. The Russians hold all the high ground around Konstantinivka, to the south, to the east, in Chasiv Yar, and now increasingly to the west. They are able to track and monitor whatever takes place in Konstantinivka. There are only two supply roads able to send supplies into Konstantinivka from the north, from Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. That supply road, those supply roads, are under constant observation and attack from the Russian drones. There is now ample footage of Ukrainian vehicles trying to move south along these roads into Konstantinivka and being destroyed there by the Russian drones. There is a pile-up of destroyed vehicles. It is very like the recent destruction of Ukraine vehicles in Olympiyskiy Street, north of Pokrovsk, during the recent battles that took place there. Only I suspect that if anything, this time, it is on an even bigger scale. And of course, these Ukrainian troops that continue to be funneled into Konstantinovka down this road of death, which for many of them it must be, are going to enter a town where the Russians already control significant portions of, where the Russians are on every side, and where the road supplies from the north are becoming very uncertain. By any logic, Konstantinovka is undefendable. I remember Ukrainian soldiers saying this at the time of the fighting in Bakhmut, which is, by the way, not that far away. But Zelensky and Sirsky, of course, will not retreat from Konstantinovka. As Zelensky has just said, the Ukrainians don't give up any ground. So even though the men in Konstantinovka are surrounded, even though the Russians hold the high ground, even though the Russian drones patrol the roads, even though the Russian artillery is active, even though Russian troops are fighting inside Konstantinovka itself, the Ukrainian men have to continue to go into the city. The supplies have to continue to be sent. People die to defend a city which realistically is already effectively lost. And of course, all of this is going to be justified eventually by the need to buy time. But of course, the reality is, as I said already, that Ukraine is running out of time. Time is working to the advantage of the Russians, not the Ukrainians, which is why the Russians, as they've just said, are not in a hurry. They're not in a hurry in the negotiations, and they're certainly not in a hurry on the battlefronts. And there are reports about the fighting further north in Liman. Denis Bushilin, the head of the Donetsk regional government, I should say the Russian-controlled Donetsk regional government, is saying that the Russians are indeed fighting inside Liman. There's fighting inside Liman going on. The way he spoke makes me think that the Russians now have gained the advantage in the fighting in Liman. Perhaps fairly soon this town will fall. And I understand that if it does, the Russians control the high ground in other places closer to Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, to the northern end of the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk conurbation. If there is a big offensive being prepared by the Russians, then it seems to me that everything that they are currently doing can be explained quite plausibly as preparatory steps in advance of it. I wonder whether discussions about that possibility are ongoing, either in Kiev or in any Western capital. I'm going to make a guess. My guess is no, because of course they believe, they've convinced themselves that the reality is otherwise, that the Russians have suffered impossibly heavy losses over the course of 2025. And far from being in a position to prepare for offensives, they are in effect exhausted, though there is no evidence of this. And would the Russians really be being saying, as Peskov has said today, that they are going to take their time if they were as exhausted as many people in the West choose to think? Anyway, that is the situation in Ukraine. Over the next couple of weeks, I suspect we'll be hearing less about the negotiations in Abu Dhabi, which will continue, but be slow and incremental. and a lot more information on the battlefronts. I don't expect to be doing more programmes about the talks in Abu Dhabi, at least until the next meeting next week, and perhaps not even then, if I have to be honest, though we shall see. Anyway, in the meantime, all sorts of other things continue to take place around the world. The Iranians are busy making very strong warnings, giving very, very strong warnings about the build-up of US forces near their country. The United States still talks about negotiations with Iran. I always take the view that when you assemble huge armadas of ships and men and aircraft, and you're the United States, then sooner or later you're going to use them. It hasn't always played out like that with Iran, but frankly, given the belligerence of the current president and his officials towards Iran, I think that sooner or later President Trump will order another attack on Iran, and he has the forces in place now that he probably feels are sufficiently strong to do it. In Venezuela, the Delcy Rodriguez government has categorically denied the story in The Guardian that she was in any way involved in discussions with the Americans that led up to the abduction of President Maduro. Well, I have to say, you would expect such a denial. I still think, more likely than not, there is some truth to this Guardian story after all. The Russians have reacted very, very negatively to rumours that the United States might be considering a blockade of Cuba. They said that they are alarmed by these reports and that they strongly oppose them. And, well, we'll see what, if anything, they do. And in China, there is a very strange crisis underway. The most senior military official, Yang Zhang Youxia, has apparently been dismissed and perhaps arrested. And there are rumours that he was accepting bribes and was passing information to the Americans about China's nuclear weapons program. So, an interesting situation in China. I would quickly say that I've again seen talk of a possible coup in China. I see absolutely no sign of anything like that taking place. These are, at the moment, rumours that appear to originate with one individual. I don't myself believe that anything like that is in fact taking place. And in Britain, we have another political crisis involving Keir Starmer. I'm not going to get into the details of it in this programme. Anyway, that's where we are. Negotiations to end the conflict in Ukraine started very late in the day. The Russians taking their time, completely uncompromising, focused on winning the war. And that, I think, is where we're going to stay, at least for the next few months. I don't know what the Americans are going to do. The slovenly appearance of their delegation to these talks may suggest that they haven't appreciated the length of the marathon that they're going to have to run. I think they need to start thinking about that, dress more appropriately, and start game planning for a long, tough negotiation, and do so right away, certainly before the next meeting next week takes place. Well, this is where I finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.